Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. On today's program, we'll look at China and its place on the world stage from both the global and regional perspective. Why China is important to our area in just a couple of moments. But first, The Contest of the Century. That's the title of a new book by our guest, Jeff Dyer. He's an award-winning journalist for the Financial Times and former correspondent in China who has written extensively about that nation. He looks at the world's two great powers and their competition to reign as the world's most powerful and influential nation. The Contest of the Century is subtitled The New Era of Competition with China and How America Can Win. Jeff Dyer, welcome. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Big subject. I'm not sure an hour, even a better part of an hour, is enough time, but a big subject indeed. Jeff, how would you characterize the relations between the two countries right now?
Well, it is a mixture of cooperation and competition. There are very strong cooperative aspects, the very powerful economic links between the two nations of trade and investment and finance. But what you're also seeing is this growing competitive aspect to the relationship. China is building up a navy, which is in lots of ways directed at slowly pushing the U.S. further out to sea in the Western Pacific. China is trying to beef up its currency to make it a global currency that can challenge in some way the U.S. dollar. And it's also doing things like taking its media companies overseas in ways that it hopes will eventually challenge people like CNN and other big Western media organizations. So you have these two competing, quite contrasting dynamics, this deep-seated cooperative aspect, but also this growing competition that's really beginning to change the way that politics is being played out.
We've seen both sides of this to a certain degree just most recently. Secretary of State Kerry, just has come to some sort of an accommodation with the Chinese, apparently, on climate change. And then we have the reaction of the Chinese to the visit by the Dalai Lama to the White House just a couple of days ago.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, climate change is one of the areas which the administration in Washington really hopes that they can build a good relationship with China on. And specifically, they're working on something like shale gas, where China has huge potential deposits of shale gas, but doesn't have the technology to exploit it, and it doesn't have the bureaucratic know-how to how to exploit it. So it's looking to the U.S. for cooperation on that front. But as you saw last week as well with the Dalai Lama, I mean, that's a very, very toxic issue for the Chinese, and they lashed out very aggressively when the president said he was going to meet the Dalai Lama. So again, that was a classic example of these two dynamics.
Well, I think they said something like this is going to have a toxic effect on the relations between the two countries. Is that something that's just kind of a pro forma comment, or do you see that it will have a toxic effect?
I think in this specific case, this was just more ritual rather than substance. Yeah. I mean, every American president for the last 20 years has met the Dalai Lama several times, and the Chinese have always said these kinds of things and never really followed through on it. However, this does have an impact on other countries. They've successfully really bullied European countries to stop meeting the Dalai Lama. The last one to do that was the British Prime Minister, David Cameron, and he got put in the deep freeze by the Chinese for 18 months afterwards. They cut off diplomatic ties. So while they tend not to do anything to the U.S. because the U.S. is just too big and powerful, they have used this kind of pressure to stop other countries from engaging with the Dalai Lama.
I wonder how the Chinese might be looking at what is happening in Washington today, and that is the top people in the Pentagon are saying we're going to reduce the size of the U.S. military. What do you think?
Well, there's certainly some people in China who think that, in the Chinese military especially, think that this is our time. And one of the reasons they think that is because they just see the U.S. as slowly declining. They see its ability to project power in the Western Pacific is slowly just ebbing away. But then other people are a bit more hard-headed, a bit more cautious about it. And they if you actually look into the figures of where the Pentagon's projecting its budgets, it has ring-fenced a lot of what it does in the Asia-Pacific region. It's gone out of its way to say, even though we're making cuts, that's really going to affect the things like the army that were involved in Iraq and involved in Afghanistan. But the Navy and the Air Force, which is the really key bit in the Western Pacific, we're going to keep all those assets. And so actually, these headline cuts might not have a huge amount of impact on the way the U.S. behaves in Asia.
How are the Chinese reacting to President Obama's statements about increasing its sphere of influence in the Pacific Ring?
Well, so there's been two different kinds of reactions. I mean, some people say this is containment. They say this is an American strategy to hem us in, to stop us from rising. This is America ganging up with all our neighbors to try and push us down. But a lot of people have realized that actually what's really been happening in Asia in the last few years is not the U.S. reimposing itself, but actually lots of China's neighbors have become very worried by the way that China's behaving, very worried about what they think a powerful China would mean. And so they've been calling on the U.S. to get the U.S. much more engaged in the region. It's really been much more a case of a demand from Asia rather than Washington trying to force itself on the region. And some people in China realize that and realize that they need to soft pedal a bit with the way they've been behaving with their neighbors.
That plays very much to our advantage, does it not? Because we still have, I think, as you put it in the book, deep roots. Even though our influence is waning somewhat, we still have deep roots in that part of the world.
Absolutely. I mean, if this was just a case of like a competition between the U.S. and China, the U.S. would lose in Asia for the simple reason that it's 8,000 miles away. Just the tyranny of geography would be very much to China's advantage. Mm-hmm. But the big advantage that the U.S. has is so many of the other countries in Asia very much want the same things that the U.S. want. They want freedom of trade across the Pacific. They want freedom of navigation. And they want a political system in Asia where they're not getting pushed around and bullied by powerful neighbors like China. And so they see the U.S. as a vital ally, a vital partner in trying to maintain a more sort of stable Asia where they're not getting pushed around.
This competition, you've alluded to this already, this competition is really going to be based primarily on economics, I assume, and the military option is less viable.
Well, the problem with the military stuff, I mean, I'm not in any way predicting sort of impending conflict or anything like that with China, but the problem when you have military rivalry and there's types of build-up, a reaction, counter-reaction of and developing armed systems against each other, is it has the capacity to really corrode all other types of interaction between countries. When leaders have their generals whispering in their ears saying, you know, you really cannot trust this country, that makes it much harder for them to be flexible to do things in other areas. So, you know, there isn't, not predicting an imminent war, but this kind of competition over the navies in the Western Pacific really does have the ability to poison lots of other interactions between the two countries.
Don't the Chinese have an advantage because of the current economics of the world situation? I mean, they're very, very powerful economically. We are struggling. They hold an enormous amount of debt in this country. It just seems to me that they have a clear advantage at this particular time.
Well, let's just take the debt issue for a start. I mean, it's the old joke that if you owe the bank $1,000, that's your problem. But if you owe the bank $10 million, it's the bank's problem. Mm-hmm. That's kind of where things are with the, you know, China's holdings of U.S. debt. So in this country, there's a very strong sort of sense that China somehow has at the edge over the U.S., that it has leverage over the U.S. In China, the political sentiment is the complete opposite. They're very frustrated. They don't understand why it is that China owns all this U.S. debt and doesn't seem to give them any influence over the Fed. There's the old joke that the Fed is much more worried about the Tea Party than the Chinese Communist Party. I mean, that's kind of really where things are at the moment. It doesn't actually really give them real power over the U.S. For the simple reason, if they were to sell their U.S. dollar holdings, the prices of those assets would plummet and China would take a massive loss and a hit to its own economy. And given that the dynamism of their economy is central to the legitimacy of the Communist Party, it's really not a very concrete threat. It's not something they can ever actually do in any realistic sense unless it was a much broader conflict.
What about Chinese investment in this country?
Well, I actually think this is an area that the U.S. should very much encourage. I mean, it's at its infancy. The U.S. only gets about 1% of Chinese overseas investment. But I think there's something that the U.S. should very much encourage for two reasons, really. First reason is the U.S. needs the money. I mean, if you want to have a more broadly based economic recovery, not the recovery we've seen since the crisis where just the stock market and the 1% have benefited, but a broadly based recovery that helps manufacturing, helps business, and helps employment, then you need investment from countries like China. That could be a great asset. The second reason is I think that it's actually politically quite an interesting strategy for the U.S. The biggest constituency that China has supporting it in the U.S. has always been multinational companies, all those companies that have operations in China. And so whenever there have been points of tension, they've sort of intervened and asked the administration to cool things down. The U.S. could benefit very much by having that same kind of constituency in this country. Senior members of the Communist Party have a direct economic stake in the U.S. economy. That's a powerful potential point of leverage that the U.S. could have to exert influence over politics in China.
What about U.S. investment in China?
Well, there has been huge amounts of investment in the last couple of decades. I mean, one of the difficult stories is that's now becoming much, much harder. I mean, the economy is growing bigger, but the bit of the pie that foreign companies are able to get at is growing smaller. Over the last 5 years, the Chinese government has introduced a whole series of policies that are gradually making life a lot more difficult for multinational companies. And that's a really difficult political tough issue for the U.S. and for the Europeans and for other countries, which they're trying to get some kind of purchase on, but it's very hard.
Is there in any sense an Americanization taking place in China. You've lived there. I have not. But we do read about some of the multinational or some of the American corporations you've spoken of, but like Pizza Hut and Burger King and some of those iconic, if you want to call them that, kinds of enterprises from this country showing up there.
I mean, at a superficial level, you see that kind of westernization everywhere in China, these kinds of brands, cars, just the way cities look in China these days look and feel quite like American cities. Big, broad highways everywhere. People drive everywhere to the gas stations and drive-thrus. And you know, McDonald's is rolling out thousands of drive-thrus across the country. So there is that aspect to it. But also this is a very long-standing, deep-rooted civilization. It's a very strong sense of its own identity. So once you scratch beneath the surface, you find that kind of Western gleans quickly disappears and get a much deeper sense of China.
You spend some time in your book talking about how China wants to replace the dollar as the world's leading currency. This may be a little too technical for me, but hopefully not for our audience. What do you mean by that? How does that work?
Well, the U.S. actually gets a lot of advantages by the fact that the dollar is the predominant currency in international business. I mean, it's not just official trade is done in dollars, but if you're a Mexican drug lord, you like to have dollars. If you're the black economy is also in dollars. Mm-hmm. And that gives the U.S. lots of advantages, one of which is that it allows the U.S. to borrow more money than otherwise would be able to because it's financed in its own currency. So that but when countries have a currency crisis, and they borrow lots of money in foreign currencies, that means that when their currency goes down, the cost of that borrowing really increases. But if the U.S. currency falls in value, that doesn't affect the U.S. in the way they have to repay its debts. So that gives the U.S. a big, big economic advantage. And the Chinese feel that the U.S. has abused that advantage. Economists sometimes call that the exorbitant privilege that the U.S. enjoys because of the position of the dollar. And one of the things the Chinese are doing is trying to slowly chip away at that kind of advantage the U.S. enjoys, to sort of rein in that privilege that the U.S. enjoys.
But they would want to do it slowly, would they not, simply because they hold so many dollars?
They would want to do it slowly. It's not something – this is a glacial thing. It's not something that's going to happen overnight. But they do think that the U.S. has this kind of power. It gives the U.S. an advantage, and they would like to have some of – they would like to sort of take away some of that power that the U.S. has.
We were talking with Jeff Dyer. He's the author of The Contest of the Century, The New Era of Competition with China and How America Can Win. By the way, Jeff is going to be appearing tonight at 7 o'clock at the St. Louis County Library headquarters. That's on Lindbergh, just south of Highway 40. We'll come back and continue our conversation about the state of the relationship between the United States and China with Jeff Dyer in just a moment. If you'd like to get into this discussion, we'd love to have you. So give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. We'll take an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. And if you'd like to send us a tweet, do so at STL on air. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation with Jeff Dyer about the status of relations between the United States and China and the competitive relationship between the two nations. He is the author of the book, The Contest of the Century, The New Era of Competition with China and How America Can Win. But before we continue that conversation, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio and the Beacon Newsroom is following today. It's unclear whether Missouri voters will get a say this year on raising the state's minimum wage above $7.35 an hour. Groups have not yet started gathering signatures for ballot initiatives raising the minimum wage, and Democratic-sponsored bills on the issue aren't likely to gain traction in the GOP-controlled General Assembly. And St. Louis musician, songwriter, and preservationist Poik Lafarge says the Palladium Building and Grand Center should be saved. The Palladium showcased prominent African-American musicians, including Nat King Cole, Ella Fitzgerald, Miles Davis. Visit our website at stlpublicradio.org to read or listen to that commentary, and visit our webpage to follow local and regional news stories throughout the day. And join us tomorrow on this program for a conversation about historic preservation in St. Louis. Now back to our conversation with Jeff Dyer. You know, Jeff, one of the things that people point to in the relationship between these two countries right now is the amount of hacking that apparently is going on. I'm sure it's not one-sided, but all we're hearing about is how the Chinese basically have entree into our Pentagon, our government offices, and just about anything else they want. What do you think?
That's absolutely true. What the U.S. government would say is that You know, all governments hack, all governments spy, and the US government presumably does lots of hacking to China to find out what it can about the Chinese military and about what the Chinese government is doing. What they would say is that what China does differently is that it also hacks into the business of private companies in this country, takes technology, takes trade secrets, and then passes them on to companies within China. So it's using its hacking, it's using its electronic spying to benefit Chinese companies. The interesting thing about this was that the administration really tried to make a big push about this in the first half of last year. They really wanted to put the pressure on China to try and cut down on this. They tried to get other countries involved as well. And then someone called Edward Snowden came along, leaked all this information about what the NSA is doing, and completely blurred the whole issue. And so the US has found that that particular campaign to try and get China to change its ways has just collapsed. There's just no real way the US can exert pressure on China over that one.
But given the targets that the Chinese hackers are using, it just reinforces once again the importance of economics to them.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, they have political and strategic motives. I mean, they're trying to find out what the Pentagon's up to, just like lots of other countries mm-hmm. are. But there is this other economic component. I mean, they see this kind of cyber espionage as part of industrial policy. They see it as a way of boosting and benefiting Chinese companies mm-hmm. and benefiting the broader economic power of the nation.
How would you characterize the leadership in China right now? How is it different from Mao, for instance?
Well, very interesting thing going on at the moment is you have a new president who's been in power now for about the last 18 months, Xi Jinping. He's really trying to set himself up as a very much more decisive leader than China's seen in the last decade or so. Under the previous leadership, there was a sense that power was really dispersing away from the top leaders, more towards the top echelons of the Communist Party. It was almost like government by committee rather than by a top leader. So Xi Jinping is very much trying to show that he's more decisive, he's more in control, and he's the one dictating terms. And that's important because he has a very ambitious economic agenda that he wants to introduce in the next couple of years to try and liberalize important parts of the economy, because they think that's the only way that they can keep these high growth rates going. But to do that, he's going to have to take on a lot of very powerful vested interests within the Communist Party, big state-owned companies, really big local governments. These are people who have resisted reform for the last decade. And so he feels he needs to really beef up his position to present himself as a strong man if he's going to be able to take on some of that internal opposition.
And what is the relationship between leadership in China and the people?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, it is an authoritarian regime. There are no elections. At the same time, the party does try and take some sort of account of public opinion. It monitors the internet very closely to find out what people are saying. It even has experimented with kinds of opinion polls to try and take the temperature on certain issues. I think one of the interesting ones for the US, though, is the relationship between foreign policy and public opinion. You have a very kind of strong internet-based nationalism within China that's really come up strongly in the last decade or so. Very anti-Japanese, but also quite skeptical about the US. And that's the kind of interesting one, because it's potentially driving China to have a more aggressive, assertive foreign policy. The last thing you want to do as a leader or a politician in China is look to be weak towards Japan or towards the US. And so it's reducing the space the leadership has to be flexible when it deals with other countries, reducing the space they have to back down, and just pushing them in the direction of taking a more confrontational attitude.
Well, while we're talking about the relationship between China and other countries, let's take a phone call from Russ, joining us from Ferguson, who wants to get into that part of the discussion. Russ, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. My question is more just asking for a comment. About a year ago, I read that China is buying, they're building a lot of infrastructure for countries in Africa in order, and they're doing it for free, including railroads as well as roads, in order to gain access to their mineral deposits and their natural resources. And I'm wondering, whether this is so that they are less dependent on people like us, or if he has any comments on that particular aspect of their expansion.
It's a very interesting question, and absolutely true. China has been investing heavily in Africa and also bits of Latin America in the last couple of decades to get resources. And part of that investment has been in infrastructure and roads and ports and railways to get the copper, to get the iron ore from the mines to be able to put them on ships. I think people from the US should not see this as a threat. There seems to me to be good news for Africa. In fact, in the last decade, African growth rates have increased quite a lot, partly because of this Chinese demand. And so I don't think we should see this as some sort of threat, as if China is being the new colonialist or anything like that in Africa. It's potentially, it's a win-win situation. They're potentially bringing something, bringing demand and bringing investment that these African countries need, and which they haven't really seen for the last couple of decades.
But they're also making friends in these countries, which is something that could potentially be harmful to us.
Well, I think they're... The way I'd say it is the following. There are good reasons and bad reasons for the U.S. to want to be more involved in Africa. The good reasons are lots of African countries have actually been a success story in the last decade, despite all the stories we get about, you know, war and terrorism. There are actually lots of success stories in Africa. That means there are more consumers, more middle-class consumers in those countries who are potential clients for American companies. That's a very good reason for America to want to be more engaged. The bad reason is this kind of Cold War thing that if China's planting its flag in some country, we need to be there too. That's a very bad game to get into. If China is able to benefit the economy of these country of these countries in ways that the U.S. simply cannot, and it gets political influence from a result of that, well, good luck to them. You know, they're actually doing something that the U.S. and Europe haven't really been able to do in the last few decades. And I don't think we should see this as a zero-sum competition. Just because they're there, we need to be there too.
This can't be characterized, this relationship cannot be characterized as any kind of a Cold War.
It's not a Cold War in the sense that, you know, the U.S. won the Cold War by bringing down the Soviet economy, essentially. I mean, that was when the Cold War ended. And that's absolutely not what the what is going on or what the U.S. should be thinking about. But there are, you know, Cold War echoes, definitely, in some of this competition. The risk that you get into these kinds of arms races of reaction and counter-reaction. And you are seeing some of the sort of military chicken that characterized the Cold War. You're seeing that with the U.S. Navy and the Chinese Navy in the South China Sea. You're seeing that with the Chinese Navy and the Chinese Air Force and the Japanese in the East China Sea. So there are very strong Cold War echoes there. But then, you know, this final point is that the U.S. shouldn't think about this as, you know, we need to be wherever we need to, you know, wherever China plants its flag, we need to be there. The U.S. cannot be, you know, be in China's shadow following it around the world. The U.S. needs to focus on the areas it's interested in and not to worry about the other areas.
Yeah, you begin your book talking about the Chinese Navy's expansion and the South China Sea situation, where I don't know how you plant a flag in the middle of the ocean, but that's exactly what they're trying to do.
Literally, on the seabed, they've been planting flags. Right,
so. Exactly. So it seems to me that if there is going to be a clash, a military clash, that this is a likely place for that to happen.
I think the most dangerous place at the moment would be in the East China Sea and over these disputed islands between Japan and China. The Japanese call them the Senkaku Islands and the Chinese call them the Diaoyu Islands. And the U.S. is committed by treaty to defend Japan if there was some sort of Chinese invasion or some sort of Chinese, you know, attempt to take those islands. That's a very toxic one because the nationalism in both Japan and China is very strong. There's very negative sentiment in both countries. And because you're seeing precisely this kind of military chicken take place between Chinese ships and Chinese airplanes and Japanese ships and Japanese airplanes, the risk is not that Chinese will invade the islands. It's possible, but probably unlikely. The real risk is that you'll get some sort of accident where two planes clash into each other or two ships clash into each other. And then you get a sort of a reaction building out of that, populations in both countries acting very aggressively, pushing their leaders to take more steps. And there you could get something quite quickly could become a very nasty incident, a very nasty conflict, which the U.S. might feel obliged to get involved in.
You mentioned those islands. I think back to the islands of Komoi and Matsu, and which brings us to the Formosa or Taiwan situation. We don't hear much about that anymore.
Well, that's one of the curious things about this conversation, actually, is that while there is this, you know, growing competition and naval rivalry, if you like, between the U.S. and China, Taiwan has really actually improved as an issue. It's a much more stable situation. And you know, you're seeing the Taiwanese government have quite sensible adult conversations with the Chinese government about economic collaboration. And there is a sort of, I wouldn't say status quo, but there's a sort of semi-consensus that, you know, Taiwan will remain. It will never be officially an independent country. The Chinese will never allow it to have a seat at the UN or something like that. But it basically runs its own affairs. It's, you know, a quasi-independent country. And that's probably not going to change in the near term.
Let's take another call. Zach is joining us from Washington, Missouri. Zach, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I have a friend who's on his second contract right now over into China. He teaches English to Chinese grade schoolers. And I just thought that was kind of interesting, you know, seeing the motivations of, you know, China compared to America. I don't see a lot of American kids getting taught Chinese in school or anything like that. So that was kind of interesting. And then another comment, he kind of told me a little bit about what life's like over there and how many different languages they even speak within China. I want to say it's like 15 plus different dialects and languages, and even the different currencies that they use. So it seems pretty complex and like not very unified. Just some comments. I'd like to see if your guests like to comment on. Thanks.
Oh, thank you, Zach. The English question is a really, really interesting one. Sometimes people in China call it the English fervor. In the last decade, this new middle class that's grown up in China, they're really obsessed about learning English. They see there's a way to get ahead in society, to get on in professional life, maybe to have a chance to travel overseas. And so according to the British Council, which is a British organization that sponsors English language education, there are now more people in China learning English than there are in India. Even though India is English is a sort of secondary language of India. That gives you a sense of the huge interest there is in language training and the huge interest there is in English, and this deep ambition you get in this young Chinese people who do want to get ahead.
You know, I have several acquaintances who have spent time in China and lived there for periods of time, and they talk about the school situation and say that they are so far ahead of us that it's just – well, it's just one of these things that we should be fearful of, that they take this so very, very seriously.
China is a very diverse country. There are schools in somewhere like Shanghai, which is a very developed city, which are fantastic schools. But if you go out west into much poorer bits of the country, then you get much, much weaker schools. I mean, really, it's still a sort of third world country in those bits. So you can't really draw too close a lesson. But I think the broader point is, again, if there are things you can learn from China about how they're educating their kids and how they run their schools, and that seems a very good thing. And we shouldn't necessarily be afraid of it. We should think, are there things that the Chinese doing, or the Singaporeans who also do very well in these international exams, or the South Koreans, are there things we can learn from them? And we shouldn't be too proud and actually go and learn those things.
Do they invest heavily in education?
Very much so. I mean, both the government invests quite heavily, and also at a family level, it's very much seen as a priority. I mean, it's one of the one-child policy actually exaggerates this, because you do have these families that you have four grandparents and two parents and then one child they focus all their energies on, and they see as getting a good education is absolutely the key to giving this child a good chance for success in life.
Isn't the one-child policy changing?
It has changed. In fact, for a lot of people in China, it hasn't really been a one-child policy for a long time. And even in the last year or so, they've further sort of loosened the restrictions. So that for a lot of people in China, it's really a two-child policy. But there are still bits of the country where it is enforced rigorously. And when it is enforced, it can be enforced in a very brutal manner with, forced abortions and forced sterilizations. And there's a really, really ugly dark side to it as well.
We can't talk about China for any length of time without talking about human rights, which is something that we bring up every time the word China comes into the conversation. How do they look at that and are keep pecking away at this at the human rights situation there?
The way I describe it is, if you got a bunch of young Chinese students in here and ask them what they expected about the future of the country, if you ask them do they want to see elections, they probably say no. I mean, they see our elections, they see the $2 billion spent 2 years ago, and they remember Bush Gore, and they're not particularly impressed by elections per se. And so a lot of people come away and say, well, China's not really interested in democracy. But then if you ask those kids, would you like to see, are you happy with the kind of censorship of the media that the Communist Party enforces? They say that's terrible. Of course they want to get away from that. And they would love to have a much more independent legal system than the one they have now, with a party dictating everything. And they would like to have much more space for civil society to organize clubs and social organizations and other groups, the kind of things that the Communist Party is allergic to because it sees them as the bedrock of a potential future political opposition. Yeah. And so within that, what you have is there's a lot of pressure within Chinese society, particularly from this growing educated middle class, not for democracy, but for a more plural, open political system. And if the party can't find a way over the next decade or so to respond to that kind of pressure, then you could start to see political problems in China.
Yes, you've indicated that the leadership may in fact be afraid because people are more interested in individualism than they are in the state.
Oh, absolutely. But one of the interesting things that happened in China in the last 5 years is that actually the system has become less liberal. It's become less open. Until maybe 5 years ago, you could tell a story that say, well, China's still quite a repressive authoritarian country, but it's getting more relaxed. People are enjoying more and more opportunities than the parents did. But in the last 5 years, the system has actually closed down a lot. They've really clashed down on dissidents and intellectuals and human rights activists and other of the kind of more awkward members of Chinese society in a way that makes it much harder to have a more sort of optimistic outlook at how this is going to play out.
only a couple of minutes left. Let's get down to the subtitle of the book, How America Can Win in This Competition with the Chinese. So how do we beat them?
Well, the first thing is that on the military side, I mean, the U.S. is going to face a whole series of very subtle challenges in the next decade, particularly around these kinds of islands and the East China Sea, South China Sea, and you know, the way the U.S. Navy operates in those areas. None of them is going to be a sort of a cause for war, but there's going to be a series of ways in which China is going to test the U.S. and pressure the U.S. And the U.S. has to find a way to subtly but firmly push back, but without being too aggressive. That's going to be very hard, but it's something the U.S. has to do, you know, very decisively if it's going to maintain its position in Asia. Second thing I think is that the U.S. is going to have to focus much more. I live in Washington, D.C., and on any given day of the week in Washington, you can find someone who will say that every nook and cranny in the world is a vital American strategic interest. The U.S. doesn't have that luxury anymore. It's going to have to decide which of the bits of the world it's really interested in and which of the ones it's not so focused on, and it's going to have to focus its attention much more.
Do you have the sense that the current leadership in Washington, if you will, at all levels, gets this?
So the U.S., the Obama administration in 2011, 2012 launched what they call the Pivot to Asia, particularly under Hillary Clinton as when she was Secretary of State. And this was very much a sort of decisive attempt by them to say that we see Asia as the crucial part of our long-term future. And that was very successful in 2012. But already in 2013, the administration has lost some of that. John Kerry, for all sorts of good reasons, is very focused on the Middle East and Iran and the peace process in Syria. And then the president was supposed to go to Asia last year, and he had to cancel because of the budget crisis and the government shutdown. So already they've lost a bit of that momentum, and the Chinese are going around Asia saying, look, you can't rely on the Americans. You know, they've got distracted again. They're worried about other things now. They're not really worried about Asia. And so that's the trick, is to be very disciplined and focused. And so this is a long-term initiative. It's not something that just 1 year or some two policies can solve.
Are you optimistic that we can pull it off?
I think so. I mean, I think some of the underlying trends are very powerful for the U.S. As I was saying, you have all these potential partners and allies in Asia who very much want the U.S. to be involved, who see the U.S. as a vital sort of guarantor of their security. And so the balance of power is very much in America's favor if it can develop smart and disciplined policies to back that up.
We only have a very short time left, and our next segment is going to be dealing with how this region can work with China and expanding trade. What is the best advice you could give business leaders in a place like St. Louis, Missouri, to work with the Chinese and be successful in expanding trade?
I'm a great believer that areas like this can benefit a lot from Chinese investment. There's a whole wave of Chinese companies in industry and manufacturing who are desperate to come to the U.S. to learn skills and to buy technologies. The U.S. should be actually encouraging this. You know, if the U.S. tries to shut out these Chinese companies, then you're almost asking them to try and steal your technologies. If there's a legitimate companies that come with good money and want to buy, as long as they're non-military technologies, the U.S. should encourage this. Now, you have to be careful. There has to be due diligence. You have to make sure that these companies are legitimate companies. They're not. There are lots of sort of people out there who are spinning a story. But the underlying potential and the underlying story could be a very powerful benefit for regions like this and for the U.S. as a whole.
Yeah, we had a bad experience in the central part of the state with the MAMTEC situation.
Absolutely, yes. And that's the kind of thing that, that can happen and you have to be very careful about. But I'd hope that wouldn't sort of undermine the underlying story, which could be a very beneficial one.
Does St. Louis seem like a good place for you to have the China hub, where this is the kind of the focal point for trade going east and west?
Oh, they're very much interested in places like this. I think that there's a great opportunity there. But there's lots of cities in the Midwest who are trying to do the same thing. Detroit is actually one of the interesting ones, which has attracted lots of Chinese interest into bits of the auto industry.
Boy, and
finding all sorts of synergies there.
If there's a community that could really use a shot in the arm, it's certainly is Detroit,
Absolutely.
Isn't it? That's Jeff Dyer. He's the author of The Contest of the Century, The New Era of Competition with China, and How America Can Win. If you'd like to hear more from Jeff, and there's certainly plenty to talk about when it comes to the relationship between these two countries, you can see him tonight at 7 o'clock at the St. Louis County Library headquarters on South Lindbergh. That is just south of Highway 40. Jeff, it's been a pleasure. Good luck with the book.
Thank you very much.
That's Jeff Dyer. When we come back, we'll look at China from another angle. We'll look at it from the perspective of our particular region and why we covet close ties with China. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU.